my days reading dead drunk poets and my nights trying to sleep with live ones. I love groped my way through the future canon. I was drawn to the same unhinged sparks of luminous chaos that had animated the old legends. I idolized the iconic drunk writers because I understood their drinking as proof of extreme interior weather, volatile and authentic. If you needed to drink that much, you had to hurt. And drinking and writing were two different responses to that same molten pain. You could numb it, or else grant it a voice. My ability to find drunken dysfunction appealing, to fetishize its relationship to genius, was a privilege of having never really suffered. My fascination owed a debt to what Susan Sontag calls the nihilistic and sentimental idea of the interesting. In Illness and Metaphor, Sontag describes the 19th century idea that if you were ill, you were also more conscious, more complex psychologically. Illness became an interior decor of the body, while health was considered banal, even vulgar. Sontag was writing about tuberculosis, but there was a durable logic connecting suffering with sensitivity, with rarefied perspective, with being interesting. In the early days of my drinking, in the shadows of all those legendary Iowa drinkers, and in the longer shadows of Faulkner, Fitzgerald and Hemingway, Poe and Baudelaire, Burroughs and his junkies, De Quincey and his opium, a canon whose boundaries I hadn't yet come to see as deeply limited. Addiction seemed generative. It seemed very much like interior decor, an accessory that spoke to inner depths. When my drinking passed a certain threshold, a threshold I imagined as an existential tunnel, hidden under the fifth or sixth drink, it plunged me into darkness that seemed like honesty. It was as if the bright surfaces of the world were all false, and the desperate, drunk space underground was where the truth lived. Novelist Patricia Highsmith's argument that drinking helped the artist see the truth, the simplicity, and the primitive emotions once more, reimagined Jack London's white logic as a visible core, something vital that remained once booze had stripped away the trivial distractions of everything else. It was another layer in the complicated, circular relationship I was constructing between drinking and making. Booze helped you see, and then it helped you survive the sight. The appeal wasn't just about intoxication, as a portal or a bandage, but about the alluring relationship between creativity and addiction itself, its state of thrall, its signature extremity. The person who found himself in that state of thrall was someone who felt things more acutely than ordinary men, who shared his living quarters with darkness. And then eventually, the drama of enthrallment became, itself, something worth writing about. But why was it always him? The old drunk legends were all men. It was like they'd built their own tombs from one another's myths, in a testosterone-steeped lineage of inflated egos and glorified dysfunction. Carver loved London's white logic. Cheever imagined himself dying like Berryman. Berryman imagined himself following in the lurching footsteps of Poe, Crane, Baudelaire. Dennis Johnson said he read only one book the whole time he was a student at Iowa, and it was Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano. It was Lowry's hero, the consul, who put it bluntly. A woman could not know the perils, the complications, yes, the importance of a drunkard's life. Maybe Elizabeth Bishop learned something about the perils and complications of a drunkard's life during her three-day binges or her decades of antabuse. Maybe she knew something about them by the time she died of a cerebral aneurysm in 1979, when the alcohol-thinned blood vessels of her brain finally burst. "I will not drink," she wrote to her doctor in 1950. "I'll go insane if I keep it up." And then, 2 decades later, "Please, just don't scold me for any past lapses. Please. I feel I can't bear to be made to feel guilty one more time about the drinking." Maybe Jane Bowles understood something about the complications of a drunkard's life when she stripped naked at Gita's, her favorite bar in Tangier, or when she kept drinking in the aftermath of her giant cerebral hemorrhage at 40. Maybe Marguerite Duras understood something about these complications after liters of cheap Bordeaux, or after the brutal disintoxication treatments that left her almost dead. Maybe she understood something about the shame of being a woman who understood something about drinking. "When a woman drinks," she wrote, "it's as if an animal were drinking, or a child." Female drunks rarely got to strike the same rogue silhouettes as male ones. When they were drunk, they were like animals or children, dumbstruck, helpless, ashamed. Their drinking was less like the necessary antidote to their own staggering wisdom, catalyst or salve for these Virgils to the fallen world, and more like self-indulgence or melodrama, hysteria, a gratuitous affliction. Women might know something about the complications of a drunkard's life, but their drinking would never be important, as Lowry put it, not like a man's. If they weren't drinking like children, they were drinking instead of caring for their children. A woman escaping into drink was usually a woman failing to fulfill her duties to home and family. Describing the traditional beliefs that inflect how male and female drinking have been understood differently, one clinical textbook puts it like this: intoxication in a woman was thought to signal a failure of control over her family relationships. No one knew this better than Jean Rhys. Rhys was drinking hard in Paris when her infant son was hospitalized with pneumonia. She'd arrived in early autumn of 1919, 6 months pregnant, and spent her first afternoon drinking wine and eating ravioli at a sidewalk cafe. "I've escaped," she wrote of that first day. "A door has opened and let me out into the sun." Even though they were young and poor, Rhys and her husband, Jean Langlais, a Belgian expatriate who worked as a journalist and spy, lived happily in a cheap hotel room near the Gare du Nord, where he made them cups of chocolate over their flambe bleu each morning, and they drank wine on the wrought iron balcony each night. "Paris tells you to forget, forget, let yourself go," Rhys wrote. But years later, she worried she had let herself go too fully. "I was never a good mother." She let her baby, William Owen, sleep in a little basket near the balcony door, and at 3 weeks old, he fell ill. "This damn baby, poor thing, has gone a strange color," she remembered thinking, "and I don't know what to do. I'm no good at this." William was taken to the Hospice des Enfants Assistés, and a few nights later, when the hospital said he had a severe case of pneumonia, Rhys grew anxious because he had not been christened. Her husband brought her the only thing he knew could calm her down: 2 bottles of champagne. "By the time the first bottle was finished," she remembered, "we were all laughing." The next morning, the hospital called to say her son had died at 7:30 the previous evening. "He was dying," she wrote later, "or was already dead while we were drinking." Jean Rhys wrote about drinking with the futile precision of someone who had never escaped its thrall. She wrote 4 novels dissecting the emotional dynamics of her own drinking, but kept drinking herself into oblivion anyway, a lifelong kamikaze dive. All the self-awareness in the world couldn't keep her sober. "I know about myself," one of her heroines says to a lover. "You've told me so often." The recurring heroine of Rhys's novels is a drunk woman making a spectacle of her weeping. And her work confronts this woman not just as a mess, but as an unappealing mess, an eyesore, always clutching at the pity of others, also their love and their wallets, and degraded by her constant clutching. Rhys's heroines shuttle between dingy hotel rooms and disappointing love affairs. They drink at Parisian street cafes and in train station hotel rooms choked with smoke. When they think about love, they imagine a wound bleeding slowly. They look at flowers on the wallpaper of their cheap flats and see crawling spiders. They struggle with life, one critic observed, the way a sleeper struggles with a tangled blanket. Their lives look a lot like Reese's, itinerant, moving between various European capitals, often in love, often drunk, often broke. Her heroine's drinking is never done. It's always another brandy, another Pernod, another scotch and soda, another bottle of wine. Their public sadness is part of their crime, and booze is their accomplice. Other characters ask them, do you want a coffee? Do you want a hot chocolate? And it's like a recurring joke, always with the same punchline. No, I'd like a drink. Across the course of Reese's first three novels, drinking is a shapeshifter. It sheds its various costumes of pleasure and exposes itself as an attempt to flee the same sadness it always ends up deepening instead. For one of Reese's heroines, early in her drinking, wine suffuses an ordinary city view with meaning. It was astonishing how significant, coherent, and understandable it all became after a glass of wine on an empty stomach. Wine turns the sullen Seine outside shuttered windows into an expansive ocean. When you were drunk, she thinks, you could imagine that it was the sea. But drinking eventually becomes something more desperate. I must get drunk tonight, another one of Reese's heroines decides after her lover sends her away. I must get so drunk that I can't walk, so drunk that I can't see. By Good Morning Midnight, Reese's fourth novel, her heroine, Sasha, has arrived at the bright idea of drinking myself to death. Even the prose signals her erosion, dissolving into ellipses and drifting into the white spaces of unremembered blackout. Sasha has come to Paris after trying, and failing, to kill herself in London. She gets a cheap hotel room on a dead-end street and spends her days sleeping, taking pills to sleep more, and wandering a city that reminds her, in every cafe, at every corner, of a youth that didn't keep its promises, the marriage that ended, the baby boy who died. The novel is honest about the price of drinking, how small it makes the world, how much it saps the spirit, as well as its logistics. The ease of getting drunk on an empty stomach, the nostalgia for early days of lower tolerance. Sometimes I'm just as unhappy as you are, another woman tells Sasha, but that's not to say that I let everybody see it. A bartender stops serving her. You said that if you drink too much, you cry, her lover tells her, and I have a horror of people who cry when they're drunk. Sasha deforms the icon of the drunk genius, the poet with his ink and whiskey turning intoxication to lyric. Sasha's pieces can't sit up and write. When she gets expressive, her expression is shameful, something others ask her to hide. The embarrassment of drunken tears, not the brilliance of song. If the mythic male drunk manages a thrilling abandon, the reckless, self-destructive pursuit of truth, his female counterpart is more often understood as guilty of abandonment, the crime of failing at care. Her drinking has violated the central commandment of her gender, thou shalt care for others, and revealed itself as an intrinsically selfish abnegation of that duty. Her self-pity compounds the crime by directing her concern away from an implicit other, real or imagined, child or spouse, and funneling that concern back toward herself. Reese once wrote that she learned early that it was bad policy to say that you were lonely or unhappy. And Sasha is an explosion of bad policy. Her consciousness runs on an engine of wearisome hydraulics, bringing in the booze and pumping it out as tears. Sasha is a grotesque version of what Reese always feared she would become. A pariah who drove everyone away by showing the intensity of her unhappiness. I could deny myself, she wrote once in her diary. Then I could make them love me and be kind to me. That has been the struggle. For Sasha, that struggle, to dissemble, to pretend, is done. She cries wherever she pleases. She cries at cafes, at bars, at home. She cries at work. She cries in a fitting room, She cries on the street. She cries near the river, drinks until the river becomes an ocean, and then cries some more. Now I have had enough to drink, she thinks each night. Now the moment of tears is very near. 2. Abandon. I learned about the efficiency of drinking on an empty stomach by starting to drink when I wasn't eating enough. This was during my freshman year of college. I had made one good friend, Abby from Indiana, who had grown up evangelical and would become one of the great friends of my life. But if we weren't together, I was alone. My roommate had an unnervingly attractive boyfriend she had met on a pre-orientation camping trip. It seemed like everyone had met her boyfriend on a pre-orientation camping trip. When I looked in the mirror, I saw someone tall and ungainly, with a large nose and pleading eyes, a frizzy triangle of thick brown hair. Most evenings, I walked into Harvard's version of a freshman dining hall, the cavernous interior of an old Gothic church, its long tables surveyed by callous stone gargoyles, petrified by the prospect of finding someone to sit with. It wasn't that I assumed no one else felt this way. It was that I didn't even bother to think about it. My loneliness was a full-time job. I called my mom from payphones so my roommate wouldn't see me crying. Scheduling phone dates with my high school friends grew embarrassing because of the asymmetry in our lives. Their busy schedules and my constant availability. That time would also work for me. I was told my ex-boyfriend had hooked up with his college's mascot, a giant tree. I wasn't at ease. At school, in the dorms, among others, and starving myself was a way of acting as if I weren't fully there, as if my life were on pause and I would hit the play button again once I was happy. I looked up at lit windows and was convinced that other people were happy behind the buttery glow of their glass. I lost 5 pounds, then 10, then 15. I kept a calorie notebook in my desk drawer where I tallied everything I ate, and a scale in my closet with bright red numbers on its screen. I lived by those red numbers, whatever they told me. If I had a setback, the same weight too many days in a row, then the next day began grimly, with a trek through the cold to the law school gym, where the 1Ls pounded their feet across their treadmill belts with a robotic fortitude I knew I could only impersonate. Another girl on my hall, who also had an eating disorder, always drank cups of hot water at meals. I started doing that too. I looked unwell. One night, I took a jar of peanut butter down to the dumpsters in the basement of my dorm because I was afraid I might eat the whole thing in one sitting, and I knew that if I threw it away in my room, I could just fish it out of the garbage can. Down in the basement, before I tossed it, I scooped out some peanut butter with my fingers and ate it in gobs. Then I threw the jar away. Then I went back to the elevator. Then I returned to the dumpster, found the jar, twisted it open, and stuck my fingers in again. That was the truth of me. Not the skinny girl who never ate, but that girl with dirty fingers, leaning into the trash. I started going to meetings at the college literary magazine, The Advocate, which had its own wooden clubhouse on South Street, and even its own motto, Dulce est periculum, danger is sweet, as well as its own crest, a Pegasus flying toward God knows what kind of trouble, flying toward it since 1866, we were told. The magazine threw legendary parties and held notorious initiations. I heard that one girl had been forced to suck tampons soaked in Bloody Marys, but it wasn't easy to join. I had to spend several months comping, which was the Harvard way of saying wanting something. In this case, it meant a tryout process that involved writing 2 essays, giving 1 presentation, and showing up to twice-weekly meetings of the fiction board, where we discussed stories that had been submitted to our wooden mailbox in the library. About 25 people were comping the fiction board, and we were told maybe 5 would be selected. We sat in the sanctum, otherwise known as the second floor, which had perpetually sticky hardwood and a cluster of ratty velvet couches with stuffing and springs thrusting up through rips in their fabric. There was a bar in one corner stocked with lukewarm gin. Before I spoke, I ran every possible comment through a wash cycle in my mind, scrubbing its fabric and wringing it dry, getting rid of its dirt, trying to make it good enough to say aloud. The other compers must have been terrified too, but I couldn't see it. Not back then. I could only see them as silhouettes through lit windows, anonymous bodies onto which I projected happiness and social ease, all the things I lacked. It was selfishness, disguised as self-deprecation, claiming all the loneliness in the world for myself. A stingy refusal to share the state of insecurity with others. When I got onto the Advocate Fiction Board in October, I was thrilled. After initiation, I imagined, I would be able to stride under the dining hall gargoyles without fear, toward friends. Tray held aloft, bearing something besides cups of hot water. The theme of my initiation was World Wrestling Federation. I dutifully showed up in spandex and got taken immediately to the basement, where one of my wrists was handcuffed to another initiate's, who was also handcuffed to a clanging metal pipe. I was handed a screwdriver, my first. The next thing I knew, I was waking up in my dorm room, 12 hours later, with a note from one of the editors on the whiteboard, "Hope you're okay," and my roommate telling me that her photogenic boyfriend had stayed up the whole night checking my pulse to make sure I wasn't dead. All this was news to me. It was also news to me that you could lose a night entirely. The last thing I could remember was the first screwdriver, the tang of cheap vodka and citrus. I had shards of memory from that night, a man's body next to mine on a couch, but couldn't fit these shards together. I thought I'd been roofied. I spent months telling people I'd been roofied. Then someone told me about blackouts. A year later, I was telling a friend all about how I hadn't vomited since I was 9 years old, and she told me I'd vomited all over the inside of her car the night I'd been initiated. I made a joke, uneasily, and apologized profusely. I would make the same jokes with Daniel years later, with the same uneasy laughter, about my night in the woods with his poet friends, peeing on a tree, disappearing into the night. I did what? Why would I do that? I pictured my body during blackouts like the body of a stranger, clad in spandex, eager to belong, chugging her vodka, sucking it down, throwing it up again. I lost 25 pounds that first semester. I started getting lightheaded. It was proof of something. Of what? I wasn't sure. I worked for an immigration lawyer in Boston, doing research to help her clients' asylum cases. Had they suffered enough human rights abuses to meet the criteria necessary for political asylum? I took a second job, transcribing interviews with HIV-positive mothers. My own pain seemed embarrassingly trivial, self-constructed and sought. To get to the lawyer's office each afternoon, I walked across a broad, concrete plaza in downtown Boston, near North Station, and I remember those walks during the numb heart of January, my frozen fingers and the chill inside, my body, at that point, skeletal. One day, I got so dizzy in the hard winter sun that I sat down on the chilled concrete in the middle of everyone so that I wouldn't faint. Businessmen walked around me in their striped suits. My tailbone ached. I was already 5 minutes late to work on our Eritrea case. It was an indulgence, this weakness. I knew that. It seemed shameful that my sadness had no extraordinary source, just the common loneliness of leaving home. So I found a more extreme costume for it, the not eating. This was the thing that was wrong. But at heart, I sensed I was more like a binge eater than an anorexic, that my restrictive eating was just an elaborate front. In addition to my calorie-counting notebook, I kept another journal, full of fantasy meals I copied from restaurant menus. Pumpkin ricotta ravioli, vanilla bean cheesecake with raspberry mango coulis, goat cheese and Swiss chard tartlets. This journal was the truth of me. I wanted to spend every single moment of my life eating everything. The journal that recorded what I actually ate was just a mask. The impossible person I wanted to be. Someone who didn't need anything at all. I had two longings, and one was fighting the other, Reese once wrote in her journal. I wanted to be loved, and I wanted to be always alone. She believed that she was destined for sadness, and destined to spend her life being told to make her sadness less visible. She called her unfinished memoir, Smile, Please, a command she'd been given as a child, posing for a photographer. It was the constant pressure she'd felt from the world. Hide your unseemly angst. As a little girl, she once smashed a doll's face with a stone because her younger sister had gotten the doll she wanted. I searched for a big stone, brought it down with all my force on her face, and heard the smashing sound with delight. Then she wept for the doll, buried her, and put flowers on her grave. Reese grew up on Dominica, in the West Indies, with wreaths of frangipani in her hair. I wanted to identify myself with it, she wrote of her native island, to lose myself in it. But it turned its head away, indifferent, and that broke my heart. As an old woman, she could still remember the sound of cocktail making, the swizzle stick, and the clinking of crushed ice against the glass, like a regular pulse in the twilight. The frangipani branches bled white, not red. Everything was hot. At their family home, a ramshackle old estate, Reese's grandmother sat with a green parrot on her shoulder while her mother stirred guava jam in a coal pot and read The Sorrows of Satan. The story was simple, its ending predestined. Satan wanted grace, but it was never meant for him. Reese grew up dogged by a sense of doom. Hanging above the family silver, there was a picture of Mary, Queen of Scots, being led to her execution. Reese's writing could never fully reckon with the suffering closer at hand and larger than herself. The long shadow of slavery and her family's participation in that legacy. Her own pain was too cloistering. When she was 12, a friend of the family reached his hand up Reese's skirt. His name was Mr. Howard. "Would you like to belong to me?" he asked. She said she didn't know. He said, "I'd seldom allow you to wear clothes at all." Years later, she wrote, it was then that it began. What was it? On one level, it was the story he began to tell her. The serial story to which I listened for, was it weeks or months? One day he would abduct me and I'd belong to him. In these stories, Mr. Howard described the house where they would live, how they would stand on their veranda and watch the bats fly at sunset while the moon rose over the water. On another level, it was the sense of being cursed, of being written into a story Reese couldn't control. In later years, whenever she looked back, Reese could find relief from this story only by getting drunk or by writing stories of her own, stories that tried to make some sense of the sadness that consumed her. "I've made a complete wreck of myself," she wrote after one binge. "Or rather, I've certainly put the finishing touch to the wreck. And do you know where I was sure I'd find myself? In Mr. Howard's house." In Reese, I recognized a woman trying to write an origin myth for her own despair, trying to build a house in which it might live, a logic or a narrative by which it might be justified. But I also sensed her pain was older than Mr. Howard's house, or that his house was just one way of pronouncing something less explicable, a sense of taint or doom. "I wish I could get it clearer, this pain that has gone through all my life," Reese wrote. "Whenever I've tried to escape, it has reached out and brought me back. Now I don't try any longer. It wasn't easy just living in it." "You've no idea, darling," she jotted in her diary as if rehearsing for a letter, "how I've been drinking." Reese drank for a long time. She never forgave herself for drinking while her infant son was dying, and she kept the receipt from his burial for the rest of her life. 130 francs and 60 centimes for a carriage, tiny coffin, and temporary cross. She and Long Lei had another child who survived, a daughter named Mary Vaughn. But Reese couldn't take care of her. Mary Vaughn lived in a convent and then mainly with her father, who spent time in prison but managed to parent more consistently than Reese anyway. One time when Mary Vaughn came to stay with her, Reese exploded at the woman who'd been taking care of the girl all day, angry that the two of them had come home at 4 in the afternoon. "You're much too early," Reese yelled. Reese wanted to be alone, to drink, and to write. Reese never understood herself as a rogue genius like the drunk male writers of her generation. She was always forced to understand herself as a failed mother instead. The traditional beliefs that deemed her intoxication a badge of shame, a failure of control, might tell the story like this. When Reese drank, she was taking. She was greedy for relief or escape. When she wrote or mothered, she was giving. She was creating art or sustaining life. But the sadness that fueled her work often made her pull her care away. She wanted to be loved. She wanted to be alone. One problem with living as if your sadness takes up the whole world is that it never does. And the people who live beyond its borders often have needs of their own. At 6 years old, Mary Vaughn told a friend, "My mother tries to be an artist, and she is always crying." I got sick of starving myself. It was tedious and cold, no matter how many cups of hot water I drank. I started seeing a psychologist, who leaned forward when I told her about my mother's job. "Your mother's a nutritionist," she said, perking up. "Do you think you did this to get her attention?" "My mother wasn't that type of nutritionist," I explained. She'd written her doctoral dissertation on infant malnutrition in rural Brazil. She'd spent months weighing underweight babies in a village near Fortaleza. Her career in nutrition didn't have anything to do with the self-indulgent angst of her anorexic daughter. "Plus," I added, "I already had my mother's attention. My mother wasn't the problem. In fact," I said, "my eating disorder had been more like a pathetic betrayal of everything wonderful about my mother, especially her largely untroubled relationship to food and to her body, her selfless devotion to problems that actually merited it. I was so irritated by how obviously irrelevant my therapist's question had been." That summer, I was supposed to get jaw surgery to correct an injury I'd sustained several years before, which meant my mouth would be wired shut for 2 months. But I wouldn't be able to have the operation if I didn't weigh more than I weighed, so I allowed myself to gain weight temporarily, with the surgery as an insurance policy on the other side. I knew that I'd lose it again. For the first 2 months after the surgery, I squirted various flavors of Ensure through the small gap between my molars and the back of my mouth. With a dumbstruck, horrified awe at letting such concentrated calories into my body again, it was a relief that I couldn't get anything more inside me. But I was afraid that once they unwired my mouth and I let myself start eating again, I wouldn't know how to stop. The other self, the one I'd kept banished to my notebook of imagined meals, would keep eating forever. I came back for sophomore year ostensibly done with my eating disorder, but that other self, the one who always wanted more, the one I'd tried to starve away, wasn't gone. She was ready to drink. During the next few years, college shimmered into myth. I got initiated into a social club with a secret panel that unlocked the front door, like a magician's lair. For my initiation, I had to bring cognac, wrangled with great courage and a terrible fake ID, VSOP, which seemed like it should stand for something more glamorous than very superior old pale. And the upperclassmen drank it while I drank beefeater gin in the dirt-floored basement, which had chicken coop wiring everywhere. I had to smoke 8 cigarettes at once, with skill, without coughing, and climb on top of a 4-foot pillar while club members shone a spotlight in my face and heckled me when my answers to their questions weren't witty enough. When I was asked to close read a piece of erotic fiction in front of everyone, we all learned that my close reading skills stuck around deep into intoxication, much longer than my hand-eye coordination or my common sense. I got home at 5 in the morning, smelling like half-curdled whipped cream from a food fight, and tried to finish a paper about Virginia Woolf that was due at noon. This was living. Drinking felt like the opposite of restriction. It was freedom. It was giving in to wanting rather than refusing it. It was abandon. Abandon as in recklessness, but also sudden departure, leaving behind the starving self, its cold skeletal shell. Drinking let me live behind those lit windows I'd seen on my way to the law school gym. Late one night, I danced with a boy I liked in the middle of the advocate sanctum when I was so drunk I could barely stand. I was wearing a strapless dress that fell down to show my bra in front of everyone, and he pulled it up, and then we kissed, and I woke up the next day giddy and nervous. What would happen next? Nothing happened next. All I had was the piecemeal memory of my dress falling down to the middle of my stomach and him gently picking it up again. At the advocate, I initiated other people just like I'd been initiated, made them hand-roll cigarettes for me using the college hazing codes as rolling papers. I was supposed to be terrible to them, but I was terrible at being terrible. "Get on your fucking knees and beg," I'd yell. And then, softer, "If that makes you feel weird or uncomfortable, you totally don't have to." I inherited the expired driver's license of a woman named Teresa, who wore glasses and looked nothing like me, and loved the minor thrill of wearing glasses out just to make my false identity more convincing. Halloween of junior year, a friend of mine was dressing up as a hamburger and asked if I wanted to use his matching French fry costume. I said yes. He was a good friend. We'd been doing early morning poster runs together for a year, taping up flyers for the magazine, Submit, with our freezing hands. There's a photograph of us, the hamburger and the French fry carton, sitting side by side on one of the sanctum's ratty couches, velvet splitting at the seams. In the photo, I'm determinedly smoking my cigarette through the armhole in my fry costume, plastic solo cup at my side. I'm trying to look nonchalant, but you can tell I'm happy. He was my boyfriend for a year. He lived in a tall concrete tower overlooking the river. The whole building swayed when the wind got heavy. I loved coming back from a party and crawling into his bed drunk and breathing my gin breath into his shoulder. Getting drunk and spooning meant my body's presence had been requested. Another way to quiet the same stubborn unease I'd always felt in my own skin. The one that made me count calories, count my ribs, seek a way out. When I stepped into drinking, its buzz and glint, I felt like Wu Cao Tzu, the Chinese artist someone had once mentioned in the sanctum. As legend had it, he'd painted the mouth of a cave onto a wall in the emperor's palace, then stepped inside and disappeared for good. At a certain point in my drinking, passing out was no longer the price, but the point. This was after a breakup during my second year in Iowa. Not Daniel. I'd already ended my relationship with Daniel. Once it became more ordinary, more stable, more secure, the things I'd told myself I wanted but couldn't actually stomach. And I'd found the same giddy, headlong plunge with someone else, another poet. The relationship itself had been embroidered with drinking memories that were easy to get nostalgic about, especially when I was drunk. We'd driven to a covered bridge outside of town and drunk cold, foamy PBRs, eaten a basket of fried cauliflower, and dangled our feet over the water. We'd taken a bottle of wine into the cemetery one night and read poems to each other by the meager light of our flip phones. I started showing up in his poems, or wanted to believe I had. "I drink less since I met you," he wrote in one, as if trumping booze was the ultimate compliment. We still drank. He loved when I was drunk, he told me once, because I got as stupid as everyone else. He liked when I said simple things. I had moved out of the clapboard house on Dodge because I wanted a place of my own, and in Iowa could afford one for just under $400 a month. I was renting a stuffy third-floor studio in an old wooden house, apartment 7. It was dusty with layers of accumulated heart swell and epiphany from the other writers who had lived there. It was also dusty because I never cleaned it. I sensed it was the type of place a very old person might die in. The windows were perfectly positioned to admit no cross breeze during the summer. My oven dial had no numbers, which meant that every baking project was also an exercise in circular geometry and estimation. 325 is right about there. I became an expert in banana cream pies, which required no baking at all. I watched movies alone on my black pleather futon, drinking plastic cups of wine. I wasn't accountable to anyone. I loved that I could see a creek from my windows. One of them, anyway, though you had to press yourself against the wall to see it. But still, I loved that the creek had ducks in it. I wrote everyone I knew, "I have ducks," as if they were mine. After a few weeks of seeing each other, the poet had started spending every night at my apartment. He put my extra key on his keychain, which I took as prelude to a proposal, telling myself I was a hopeless romantic, sleeping in a vintage Chevy Camaro t-shirt that said, "Built for speed." But he eventually started to stay out later drinking. The night he told me that he needed space, I excused myself from our conversation and went into my bathroom to pull out a razor and cut myself, three strokes swelling with the old familiar beads of red. He sat in my kitchen on the other side of the wall. Then I put a band-aid on my ankle and came back out and said, "Fine." He needed space. I was okay with that. One night, I got so restless, waiting for him to come back to my apartment, that I drove to the truck stop at 3 in the morning. I left him a terse note like a country song. Couldn't sleep. Drove to truck stop. I was dead sober and nearly insane with anxiety that he was leaving and I couldn't stop him. I wanted to drive for long enough to molt my urgent need. I drank my oil-spotted coffee above the hubcap store, but the drive didn't feel like the old days, the old freedom, because it was so fully contoured by his refusal. When he finally broke up with me, it was on the stairs of my apartment building, a degraded mise-en-scene. He tried to leave as I buried my face in my arms and begged him to stay. I came up to my apartment and curled up on the floor and cried. The carpet was still filthy. In the middle of my weeping, I actually sneezed. My problem was simple but insoluble. I didn't want to feel what I was feeling. Then I saw the bottles on my fridge, clustered together like a little village. Triple Sec and Bacardi and Hawkeye Vodka and Midori. It wasn't exactly God in the clouds, but it was something. It was pragmatic. I wondered, how much till I pass out? That winter, I woke early most mornings and smoked on my fire escape in the bitter cold. Sometimes, I put my boombox in the kitchen window and blasted Tom Petty's froggy voice singing, "Don't Come Around Here No More," a song of banishing. I wanted to carve up my ex like cake, like Petty did in his video, slicing Alice in Wonderland into neatly frosted wedges. It was less that I wanted to hurt my ex and more that I wanted to bring him into me again. We had our first snow and the creek froze solid. I wondered about my ducks. Where would they go? Each day I woke up and immediately started calculating when I'd start to feel better, knowing it wouldn't be until 5 or maybe, actually, 4:30 when I let myself open a bottle of wine. It helped that it was winter and getting dark earlier. That felt like permission. I also liked giving myself a head start at home before I started drinking around other people. If I got a buzz on before I left, it helped me stay more serene at the bar, waiting patiently for everyone else to finish their first or second round because I was already on my fourth or fifth. In the meantime, I taught 2 sections of an introductory literature course. When we tried to discuss Jesus' son, I realized Johnson's main character had no name. Because his friends called him Fuckhead, we called him Fuckhead too. Fuckhead's character arc. Fuckhead's crisis of conscience. My students loved how strange his world became when he was high. "What is he trying to escape from?" I asked them, then headed home for my evening ritual. I knew that drinking as much as I'd started to drink meant I was taking in hundreds of extra calories, often more than 1,000. So it made sense to compensate by restricting my calories elsewhere. Eating less also made it easier to get drunk. 2 birds, 1 stone. I wasn't sure why anyone ate before drinking, honestly. It seemed like a waste of the empty stomach buzz. If I was eating alone, Dinner was always the same. Using one of my four plates, I took two circles of lunch meat, each one 30 calories, and eight saltines, each one 12 calories, and sliced the circles into four quarters each. Then I placed each of the eight quarters onto one of the eight crackers, open-faced sandwiches. Ever since I'd gone into therapy for my eating disorder and gained back most of the weight, I'd hovered right around what I thought of as my bloodline, the weight that meant I'd get my period. Sometimes I dipped back under it just to prove to myself that I could. It was like a secret conversation I was having with my own life. Drinking gave me another way to pronounce how bad I felt, to organize the emotion into a set of actions. One night I sat in the passenger seat of a friend's car, asking him to tell me I was better looking than my ex. It was 6 p.m. and I was already drunk. He told me exactly what I wanted to hear, and who can blame him, because how else was he going to get me out of his car? I went upstairs and passed out around sunset. I told myself that drinking was about my ex, but his absence was just the reason I gave myself. I demanded intensity from everything in my life, even the ducks beyond my window. Their survival carried the weight of epic. By spring, they were back in the creek below, same as ever, no different or better for having survived the winter. After her first lover left, Reese said, "I'm finding out what a useful thing drink is." This seemed right to me. Heartbreak wasn't the reason you drank, but it could be an occasion to discover what drinking might do for you. Reese's first lover, a man named Lancelot, had called her his kitten. "Kitten," he'd written, "you make my heart ache sometimes." When Reese got pregnant by another man after Lancelot had broken her heart, Lancelot didn't take her back, but he paid for her abortion. He gave her a rose plant and a long-haired Persian cat. Reese went to the seaside for a week. She put the Persian in a home on Euston Road, and when she came back, they told her it was dead. She wept on the top deck of a London bus. She started sleeping 15 hours a day. "And then it became part of me, so I would have missed it if it had gone," she wrote. "I am talking about sadness." Things had been lost. A man, a kitten, the possibility of a child. But something else was granted. A new vision of her oldest tenant, sadness. Something she would have missed if it had gone. The conditional tense was full of weary prophecy. It never had. It never would. The whole earth had become inhospitable to her, her friend Frances Wyndham wrote, after the shock of that humdrum betrayal. Reese was always getting accused, by other people, by critics, by readers, of making too much of her humdrum hardships. She knew the charge of self-pity, and alternately loathed herself for it and proudly owned it. She once wrote to a friend, "You see, I like emotion. I approve of it. In fact, I'm capable of wallowing in it." She was the Scheherazade of wallowing. She spun her stories from its excess. She barely survived it. Her novels got so much right about alcoholic drinking. The shut-in quality, the bait and switch, how booze promised freedom but eventually just left her on her knees, retching. After Lancelot left, Reese toured with a musical variety show making a circuit through the dreary towns of the Midlands and the North. Wigan, Derby, Wolverhampton, Grimsby. Even their names were predatory, apt. One of the boys in the company drew a sketch of tour life. The gloomy alleys, the lamp-lit rooms, captioned simply, "Why we drink." But Reese never needed a why, or else she had too many. Lancelot was only the first of many pretexts. "On an extended canvas," said one review of her work, "one becomes more than ever conscious of the unsatisfactoriness of getting drunk as a remedy for every trial and trouble." Reese ended up turning her heartbreak into a career. She took the shame of getting dumped by Lancelot and the ways she wrecked herself in the aftermath and made these things the subject of her first manuscript, Voyage in the Dark. Her heroine, Anna, is mistress to a man named Walter until he doesn't want her anymore. Even then, Anna can't bring herself to hate him. "I'm not miserable," she says. "Only I'd like a drink." The landlady scolds her for leaving her silk eiderdown comforter covered in wine stains. Anna's life after Walter is full of stained comforters and withered curls of uneaten bacon. It's full of men slipping 5 quid, 10 quid, perhaps a little more into her purse in the middle of the night, after they fuck her, then writing her so they can fuck her again, or not writing. It always comes to that, eventually. The not writing. When I first read Voyage in the Dark, Anna's objection made me physically ill. Not because I was disgusted by it, but because I recognized it. I watched her stillborn letters fan across the bed. "Dear Walter. Dear Walter. I love you. You must love me. I love you. You must love me." Drinking and missing men. Drinking and missing money. Drinking and missing home. All these got tangled together. When she's bleeding out from her illegal abortion, Anna says, "I'd like a drink. There's some gin in the sideboard." On Christmas Day, 1913, after Lancelot had a tree delivered to her boarding house room, months after ending things between them, Rhys decided to drink a whole bottle of gin and then jump out her bedroom window. A friend came over and saw the bottle and asked if she was throwing a party. "Oh no," Rhys said, "not a party exactly." When she shared her plans, her friend said she wouldn't die from jumping, she'd only cripple herself. "And then you'd have to live smashed up." Rhys didn't jump out the window, but she did drink the gin. And then she bought a notebook and started writing in it. Or at least, that's how she liked to tell the story. That she almost died, but was reborn to write. In truth, she'd kept notebooks before. But perhaps she managed better prose in this one. Perhaps it appealed to her to imagine the writing as her resurrection. During my winter of saltine sandwiches, I started sleeping with more men. This was easier when I was drunk. There was the stand-up comic, the tow truck driver, the man building his own house. Drunk sex became a way of purging feeling, siphoning it off and putting it somewhere else, like collecting the rendered fat off cooked meat and pouring it in a jar, storing it away so it wouldn't clog the drains. My workshop instructor that last semester found something seriously wrong with almost every student story we discussed, and he could spend an hour dissecting why the language wasn't working. One week, he flipped through a whole story trying to find a single phrase he liked. It took me a while to accept that he wasn't an asshole, that he was hard on us because he believed in what our writing could do. He didn't think my first submission did much. But his intelligence had an integrity and precision that made me hungry for his praise. Not getting it only sharpened the hunger. Outside the classroom, I'd met an older man who lived outside of town. I'd show up at his big house with its oven dial full of actual numbers and cook him chicken stir fry, the only dish I knew how to make. We'd get drunk, or I'd get drunk. I actually have no idea if he got drunk. We'd have sex, and afterward I'd put on one of his basketball jerseys and go cry in the bathroom. At the time, I felt sorry for myself. Now I look back and feel sorry for him, with this girl showing up at his place to cook her rubbery chicken and demanding his compliments in return, then sobbing in his bathroom, clearly wanting something from him. But what? Neither one of us knew. After a few weeks, he told me over dinner one night that he couldn't taste any of the food I was cooking. He wasn't being figurative. He had no taste buds. It was a condition he'd had since birth. Somehow this seemed sad to me, not just that he couldn't taste anything, but that I'd been making these meals without knowing he couldn't taste them. Whatever we were doing, we weren't doing it together. My desire to be wanted was like something physically gushing out of me. Need, need, need. And it disgusted me, this broken spigot I'd become. A man telling me he wanted to fuck me, whispering it into my ear, it was like taking the first sip of whiskey, that hit of warmth, straight to my gut. The beginning was usually better than what followed. The cotton mouth morning, the strange bed, sweat on the sheets. I tried to live better. I tried yoga. I got a little houseplant, and by coincidence, my friend got me another little houseplant, and so I decided to throw a little party about it. Maybe we would drink. One of my plants, a weeping ficus, hung in my kitchen above the other one, a little fern. I named them both after an Andrew Marvel poem, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. The big plant was Marvel, the little one, the annihilator. I decided my party would be green. Everything would be a green thought in a green shade. This meant lime jello shots, pistachio cookies with food coloring, celery, spinach hummus, and someone else's pot. I made my jello shots in the morning and couldn't open my liter of vodka because I'd gotten the cheapest kind and the cap was messed up. I had to run to the corner store as fast as I could. My jello was cooling by the minute, and demand vodka at 8 in the morning. I got my jello shots made, but they were too strong. It was too hot in my kitchen with too many bodies packed together. Nobody was as amused by the name The Annihilator as I'd thought they would be. One friend had just spent the previous night in jail for a drunk driving arrest. She was teary in the corner. Another friend smoked too much pot and ended up fainting on my kitchen floor. My home seemed toxic, like you could catch something, a state of frailty or an absurd despair, just from spending time in it. Several months after the breakup, my friend started to ask me, gently, kindly, why I was still talking about it so much. Why was I taking it so hard? Honestly, I wasn't sure. Rejection was a worm that kept burrowing into me, my own humdrum betrayal, and I kept trying to dig it out by getting to the bottom of why I hadn't been good enough for him. I started seeing a therapist at Student Services as an experiment. He had an accent that made it hard to understand some of his similes. "Love is like a toaster," he told me. "It comes and destroys everything." I thought, no. Love is Tom Petty on a boombox. I imagined the burnt bread heels of my toasted heart. It turned out the therapist meant twister, not toaster. And that spring there actually was one. An actual tornado flipped the whole roof off a sorority house. It tore off leafy branches and flipped cars into tree trunks. It tossed the shed from my backyard into the creek. I kept my fingers crossed for the ducks. My ducks. This was Iowa, a pathetic fallacy writ large. You spoke of love, and its metaphors came alive. They spun the air all around you. I decided to write a story about the breakup because it was all I could think about. But a breakup story seemed like artistic suicide, and I could already picture my workshop instructor flipping through it in class, pointing out my trite articulations of heartbreak. I wrote the story anyway, but I took care to make my heartbreak more dramatic. My main character smashed a glass of wine against her fridge and then licked all the red trails of Shiraz running down its beige door. I'd only ever drunk my wine from water glasses and plastic cups, but the shattered glass and licked trails of crimson seemed like more artful articulations of ache than my own redundant glugging. The day of my workshop, our instructor said, "The only thing wrong with this story is that it doesn't have any page numbers. It was the only thing I wrote at Iowa that anyone really liked, and it confirmed my hunch. Things got dark, and you wrote from that darkness. Heartbreak could become the beginning of a career." I wasn't good at taking care of myself then, myself or my weeping ficus, which withered to a crisp in the heat of July. I put it out on the fire escape so I wouldn't have to look at it dying. I wanted to believe that this new type of drinking I'd been doing, drinking intentionally and explicitly and self-consciously toward passing out, was introducing me to a part of myself I'd never known before, that I was fumbling to learn its shape, like an object under murky water. In vino veritas was one of the most appealing promises of drinking, that it wasn't degradation but illumination, that it wasn't obscuring truth, but unveiling it. If that was true, then my truth was passing out partway through the romantic comedies I watched alone at night before the booze took me under. 3. Blame.